Godspeed with Carol Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. Mindfulness is very much like the Holy Spirit. Both of them help us touch the ultimate dimension of reality. Mindfulness helps us to touch nirvana, and the Holy Spirit offers us a door to the Trinity. From the book Living Buddha, Living Christ by Thich Nhat Hanh. Our guest today is Dr. Leo D. Lefebure, Matteo Ricci S.J. Professor of Theology at Georgetown University, a prolific writer and traveler of where religious paths cross, merge, and lead each other. He is the author of The Buddha and the Christ, Explorations in Buddhist-Christian Dialogue, Life Transformed, Meditations on the Christian Scriptures in Light of Buddhist Perspectives, The Path of Wisdom, a Christian commentary on the Dhammapada, and Revelation, the Religions and Violence, recipient of the Pax Christi USA 2001 Book Award. He has also served on the board of directors of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies, was a participant in the New York Buddhist Catholic Dialogue, an advisor to the Board of Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, and is currently on the Board of Trustees for the Council for a Parliament of the World's Religions. Dr. Lefebure, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Delighted to be with you.
Now, the subject of interfaith relations and where it's going is such a vast topic and an urgent one, and one that our organization is, of course, dedicated to. But let's begin with a smaller journey to start, which will help us find our own path, your own. Would you say that you were raised in a religious household?
Yes, and I was aware of religious diversity within the Christian communion from the time I was very young. My father was Catholic. My mother was from a Lutheran family, and she became Catholic when I was very, very young, younger than I actually remember. But as I was growing up, I was very much aware I had Lutheran cousins, including one Lutheran cousin who is a Lutheran minister, another cousin who is married to a Lutheran minister. And I was fortunate that in our family, the relations were always very harmonious in my experience.
Well, that's good news, indeed. Now, as a member of the Catholic faith, your entire life, and of course your studies and all your work, what is it about the faith that you enjoy the most? Is there something that comes to mind in terms of the practice or beliefs that helps you in particular, and where do you find hope?
That's a lot of questions in there.
Yeah.
I find hope in the people that I meet. At the center of the Catholic tradition, of course, is the person of Jesus Christ. And in the Catholic tradition, often it's a very sacramental celebration of the mystery of Christ and the Holy Spirit in our lives. And it's a wonderful, rich tradition with so many really inspiring figures and much wisdom along the way. And so it's the many positive resources within the Catholic world that have given me nurturance and hope.
Thank you very much for that answer. So you began in a Catholic or Christian home that already had some diverse influences. How did interfaith studies and dialogue become such a central focus in your life's work?
Well, I was young during the time of the Second Vatican Council when the Catholic Church dramatically changed its official stance toward other religions. And so as a high school student, I remember having an assignment in which I went to interview the local rabbi. And so that's about the first exposure I had. And then another high school day, they rented a bus and took us to different Protestant churches and also to a synagogue where we met the rabbi. Then when I was doing doctoral studies later on in the University of Chicago, there was intense discussion of religious pluralism. And during those same years, a couple I knew moved to Bangkok and invited me to come to visit them. And so that led to my first exploration of Buddhist and Hindu cultures. And I was very moved by the wonderful works of art in Kyoto, Japan, in Burma, Myanmar, in Thailand itself, and also in Bali. And on that trip, I spent 5 days practicing Buddhist meditation at the monastery of Wat Rumpeng near Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand. And so that stimulated my interest. It convinced me that there was a beauty and a wisdom in the Buddhist tradition that I wanted to explore further. So those were some of the starting points.
Thank you. Now, just to touch on Vatican II again, of course, the famous phrase of, you know, throwing open the doors and the windows and, you know, letting the brush of fresh air go through at that time. Can you just touch base a little on what the approach was or attitude was before that toward other faiths or religions?
Overall, the attitude of the Catholic Church had been historically rather negative. It was often common teaching that Jews were collectively responsible for the death of Jesus, and that often lent a bitterly anti-Jewish tone to much of Catholic practice, especially during Holy Week. Sometimes Good Friday services would lead into attacks on the Jewish community. After the Second World War, many Catholics realized that even though Nazism itself was profoundly anti-Christian, this earlier history of Christian negative attitudes towards Jews and the Jewish religion had kind of poisoned the atmosphere in Europe. And so when Pope John the 23rd announced that there would be a Second Vatican Council, a French Jewish historian, Jules Isaac, asked for an audience with him and received it. And he started off by saying to the Pope that if the Jewish people had such great hopes from him, it was because they knew his goodness, because they knew he had helped to protect Jews during the Holocaust. He signed fake baptismal certificates to protect them from the Nazis.
Oh, dear.
Then Pope John issued a directive to Augustine Cardinal Bea, a German Jesuit biblical scholar, to work on a statement on the relationship of the Catholic Church to the Jewish community. This broadened out then in the course of the council to become the statement on the relation of the Catholic Church to all other religions. But in terms of the other religions, often Catholics had very, very negative views of Muslims and often of Buddhists and Hindus. There were some Catholics before Vatican II who were involved in positive relations with other religions. So there were very important forerunners, but collectively, on balance, often the attitude was more negative.
Well, I'd like to just share a brief story that you're reminding me of. When I was studying at Mary Knoll, which is a Catholic foreign mission society, I encountered a sister, a Mary Knoll sister, who had returned from several years mission in Japan. And when she was saying goodbye over there after all her work as a Christian missionary, one of her dearest friends over there who was a Buddhist gave her a tremendous hug and thanked her for helping her to become a better Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And on the long flight home, the sister was wondering, you know, had she failed? And it opened up a whole question about mission and whether it's even being done the same way anymore, if the focus has changed or has evolved, perhaps, in this direction. And so the Buddhist-Christian dialogue is, of course, fascinating, and as well as the others that are emerging. Now, can you share about your books, and if you'd like to comment on mission as well, that would be certainly invited. But Let's go to the life transformed meditations on Christian scriptures, which you have written about in light of Buddhist perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this book evolved out of a talk I gave many years ago during, I guess it was a time preparing for Lent, and I was reflecting on the traditional themes of Lent in the Catholic tradition in light of Buddhist perspectives, and people were interested and wanted to hear more, and so I worked it up into a book, and it's a series of short spiritual reflections where I begin with a brief passage from the Christian Bible and then reflect on various aspects of the Buddhist tradition that correspond, sometimes are different from, that can challenge, raise questions for Christians to ponder in approaching our own scriptures in relation to Buddha.
And this was based on your own studies and experience and travels among Buddhists and in the East?
Yes.
Yes. So you look back again at the New Testament and it looked a little different?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you share a meditation, perhaps, with us?
Yes. Yeah. The Apostle Paul writes to the Galatians, "Yet I live, no longer I, but Christ lives in me." The Japanese Zen Buddhist philosopher Keiji Nishitani interprets this saying of Paul as what he calls a Christian koan and poses the challenge, I quote him, "That makes sense to me immediately. Allow me only to ask you this. Who is speaking here?" End quote. So who says this statement? If the I who speaks no longer lives, who makes the claim? The linguistic expression of Zen Buddhist experience often takes the form of a koan, a paradoxical problem or question that a student is challenged to resolve. A Zen master once explained the role of a koan in Zen training. The koan throws a student into a steep and rugged maze where he has no sense of direction at all. He is expected to overcome all the difficulties and find the way out himself. A good koan is deliberately disorienting, baffling, disabling. In short, the role of the koan is not to lead us to Satori, awakening, easily, but on the contrary, to make us lose our way and drive us to despair. There is both in the Zen koan and in the letters of Paul a combination of a fierce commitment to discipline and a radical letting go of reliance on one's own powers, a search for one's true identity, and an experience of the death of oneself. Paul repeatedly attacks the sense of self-sufficiency, then throws students upon their own resources, but also challenges them to realize that they have no self. For both Paul and Zen, the experience of transformation is an overcoming of the separation between self and other. Paul also wrote in his letter to the Romans, "We do not know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit itself intercedes with inexpressible groanings. And the one who searches hearts knows what is the intention of the Spirit, because it intercedes for the holy ones according to God's will." So we may wonder, in the spirit of Nishitani's question, when it is the Spirit who prays in me to God, who is praying here?
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with us. Would you say that there is a natural relationship between these faiths, between the core of Christianity and the core of Buddhism?
There's a paradoxical relationship, depending on how you frame the question. If you're looking at the more philosophical side, the cosmology, there are huge differences between Buddhism and Christianity. But if you look at the practical path of wisdom, the actual virtues that each tradition values, we share a tremendous amount and are very, very close to each other. And I've been in conversations where it can go either way. At times, it seems like we're so different, it's hard to even get a basis for conversation. On the other hand, I've been in conversations where the similarities, the convergences are so much in evidence that I wonder what difference the differences make.
That's a great question in the end, you know, whether we're talking about the, you know, emptying of self and the ego or death and resurrection leading toward new life. There seems, if perhaps not exactly the same path, at least certainly beside each other in the same direction.
There's certainly the similar use of images that Zen talks about the great death and Christians enter into the death of Jesus. And so there's a radical transformation. One way I've phrased it is in Christianity, everything is related to belief in creation. God calls us into being, and all the language of estrangement, of alienation, of sin, of reconciliation, healing, new life, is in relation to a God who creates us. The Buddha didn't talk about God. People have speculated why. But Buddhists generally are wary of the doctrine of creation. I heard the Dalai Lama tell us at the first Gethsemane encounter at Thomas Merton's monastery, the Dalai Lama said, quote, "I can accept God as infinite love. I cannot not accept God as creator," end quote. And so that frames a difference. Buddhists often talk of dependent co-arising. Everything arises out of everything else. And ultimate reality is non-dual. It's not radically transcendent of the world. And so it's much more a realization of who we already are in the Buddhist tradition. But at every point, the words in both traditions are pointing beyond any literal direct meaning towards a transformed way of being in the world.
Now, let me ask you, why is it important to explore and make these connections with between Buddhism and Christianity, or perhaps with, between any faiths?
Well, on one level, we are neighbors in this world. Christians are called to love our neighbor. And so if our neighbor follows a different path of religious practice, we're called to get to know our neighbor's religious practice and to respect and value that to the degree that we can. And Buddhists often talk about the value in the Buddhist tradition of friendship with others, including Christians. In sharing spiritual experience, often there can be a growth in depth. Often aspects of our own tradition can come into new prominence and take on a different significance in light of dialogue with the other. Many Christians have experienced the practice of Buddhist meditation and have found that it enriched their prayer lives as Christians. And also in terms of social justice, for all the differences in our cosmology, there are many, many values that we share, and we face a world of overwhelming suffering and often massive violence and tremendous threats for the future. And so there's also a very practical focus on working together on issues of common concern. And also on the more theoretical level, it's important to get to know each other in terms of the history of our traditions. In the past, often religions focused mainly upon their own tradition. More and more, as we live in a global age, we realize how deeply interconnected we are. And so it's important to have accurate understandings of the other. And the only way to really overcome misunderstandings is through dialogue, through checking out our perceptions with people from another tradition, and then learning through the course of the conversation.
Yes, and that's why we're here. So many of us, not all of us, but many of us know enough about our own tradition, and the way forward, you know, begins with learning what other people actually believe. This is what we do here every Sunday. We invite everyone to come share, because once we hear each other and we hear each other's stories and hear each other's beliefs, the humanity comes through, and the love at the core of basically everyone's belief system. So in your opinion, then, how do we get around this? How do we get through this adolescence we have around God and religion that tends to lead to arguments, because when we stay in the sort of mental side of things and the ideological side of things, we do tend to stay stuck in arguments or fighting, including infighting, I mean, even within the same tradition.
I think one important first step is to get to know our neighbor. Some years ago, as part of an international Buddhist Christian studies conference, I was part of a week-long discussion on Buddhist Christian dialogue around the world, and one place after another, people agreed the key to Buddhist Christian dialogue was lunch.
Lunch?
Meaning, over lunch, people share their concerns and get to know each other as human beings. And then when they went into the more formal structure dialogue, it changed the tenor of the conversation because they knew each other in terms of their own worries, their vulnerabilities, their concerns, their hopes for the future. And so that shaped the way the more intellectual conversation could move.
Hmm.
So that's one starting point for it. I think listening is tremendously important, that often we can bring in images, and sometimes in the past, images have often been rather negative of other religious traditions, and there still often are negative stereotypes. Often the best way is to actually get to know another person from the tradition that's being negatively stereotyped, and then that usually breaks through. All these traditions are ambiguous in our history, that no tradition that I'm aware of has a perfect record of living out its best values.
Right.
And so one older way of dialogue was kind of a biased, I take the ideals of my tradition and then I look at all the imperfections of the other tradition, and guess what? My tradition comes out better.
Hmm.
But if we're more conscious of that, we can compare the ideals of both traditions and then look honestly at the problems in the practice that different traditions have had. But like looking at the Buddhist tradition, at the center are the what they call the Brahma Viharas, the dwelling places of the Buddha, which are the virtues of loving kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy, and equanimity. And those resonate very deeply with the Christian tradition. And so there we find a very strong common ground for extending this loving kindness to absolutely everyone. And compassion means seeing the suffering of others is truly our own suffering. Appreciative joy means delighting in the well-being of others. And Buddhists often warn the real challenge here is the person that you really don't like, the person you'd like to see fail. But can you extend the wish, may your success and happiness be unending? Then equanimity is coming back to the practice again and again, whether we fail or not, whether it feels good or not, but just keeping a steady balance and a steady rhythm of coming back to the practice.
Hmm.
And so each of those values both resonates with the Christian tradition and challenges Christians in terms of the way we live out our own faith lives.
Yes, and the honesty there, or moving from the head to the heart, that brings us to that compassionate core, as you said, that resonates with the Buddhist faith. And, of course, bring lunch.
Yeah.
We're about halfway through the program, Dr. Leo, and we're going to take just a brief break here. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Leo D. Lefebure, author, and Matteo Ricci, S.J., Professor of Theology at Georgetown University. Let's spend a few minutes now with the Benedictine monks of Santo Domingo de Sios. Stay with us.
Amen.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're speaking with Dr. Leo D. Lefebure, author and Matteo Ricci S.J. Professor of Theology at Georgetown University. And again, those were the Benedictine monks of Santo Domingo de Cios with their piece Sanctus XII from their Dedication of a Church selection. And we're discussing church and the changing meaning and experience of church as we evolve an interfaith and interreligious dialogue. Doctor, can you share with us now on the topic of your book, Revelation, the Religions, and Violence? I think this speaks to the core of many issues where we deal with today, and especially speak to the violence aspect around differing religious beliefs.
Yes. After a number of years of being involved in interreligious dialogue, particularly with Buddhists, I had the thought, well, we're being awfully nice to each other.
Mm.
And this is certainly an improvement over much of our earlier behavior, but it struck me that there's also the ambiguity of our religions. And so I began to reflect more directly about the problem of violence in relation to religious traditions. And I came across the work of a French Catholic scholar, René Girard, who has done much of his career in the United States. He recently retired from Stanford University. And he developed kind of an overarching theory of religion and culture, arguing that we, from the time we're young, we sense a lack inside ourselves and take others as models. And we not only want what they have, ultimately, we want to be who they are. He calls this mimetic rivalry. But we can't ever completely push them out of the way. So the more we approach them in power, the more threatened they become, and you have tensions. And so in any group over time, Girard argues, the tensions will increase. And he argues very early in human development, humans learned one way to discharge the tension is to find a scapegoat. And so if we agree that this individual or this group of individuals are the source of our trouble, the rest of us can come together, then we drive them out or at the limit kill them. And so he argues this is what he calls the primal sacred. It's this mixture of violence and religion where religion makes the violence seem natural and often willed by the gods in different mythologies. And then Girard reads the Bible as an unmasking of the scapegoat mechanism and of God coming into the world on the side of the victim and then in Jesus himself as the victim, but not fighting back, not reciprocating the violence. Because often violence itself is mimetic. If one side does something violent to the other will imitate that, and so the conflict can escalate. And he reads various figures from Joseph in the book of Genesis to the suffering servant in the book of Isaiah to Job, figures that go through suffering that are classic victims, but God appears on the side of the victim. And then the height of this for Christians reading the Bible is in the person of Jesus, where he enters a world of violence, is threatened with violence, but does not call down the legion of angels to destroy Pontius Pilate and the Roman legions, but accepts death. And Girard understands this as calling attention to these deep-seated scapegoat mechanisms in order to be free from them. Then he understands the resurrection of Jesus as God's solidarity with all the victims. In the Gospel of Matthew, when Jesus dies, various people are raised from the dead, and Girard reads this symbolically as all the different victims of history, in a sense, share in the resurrection of Jesus. And tragically, Christian history has often not learned the lesson, but Christians themselves have engaged in scapegoating. But nonetheless, there's the power of the gospel still there that can work its way to kind of see through the scapegoat mechanism and lead to healthier forms of community.
Hmm.
And then I reflected on aspects of the Buddhist tradition that have their own formulas, including the virtues we just discussed a little earlier, the Brahma Viharas, of overcoming mimetic rivalry and scapegoating. So in this book, I first name the problem of violence, and then I look at different resources in the Christian tradition for overcoming it. And I close with a dialogue I kind of construct between my own teacher in Buddhism, Masao Abe, and the German Catholic theologian Karl Rahner.
Now, the scapegoat mechanism that you mention is very interesting, and we find, for example, martyrs and violence pretty much across all religious categories and denominations and traditions. You know, at the beginnings of Christianity, and then what Christians did to others in the name of the same faith. And it's in Islam and Judaism, Buddhism. It's across the board, basically. Now, today, how does the scapegoat mechanism work in our own culture?
Often we're tempted to blame some other group as the source of all our problems, and then there's a desire to drive them out, to get rid of them, or at the limit, kill them. So at the core is an evasion of responsibility. When we're scapegoating, we're saying that somebody else is really the source of our problem. Some forms of religious nationalism can fall into this, where the national identity of a group becomes wrapped up with a particular religious identity in an exclusive way that excludes all those who don't belong to that religious identity, and then they can become targets. And this is part of the the reason for religious violence around the world today. So it takes countless different forms, but at the core it's an evasion of responsibility on our own part, and then a projecting of all the blame and guilt on the other side. And Girard says it's not necessary that the scapegoat be completely innocent. For the mechanism, the question of objective guilt or innocence really is secondary. It's more the projection from the side of the person or group doing the scapegoating that's the driving force in this.
And why do we do this? Do we believe we have something to gain by this, by imposing this kind of structure that leads to suffering, pain,
loss? Yeah, historically we gain a certain relief of tension for a time. It's never stable, and so the scapegoat mechanism will always come back again and again. But Girard looks across many different cultures throughout time and says we've repeatedly constructed societies around a lynch mob. Mm-hmm. And so we keep an unstable set of power relations by targeting a particular group as the ones responsible, and then, whether symbolically or really physically, put them to death, blame them. So you have Hitler blaming the Jews for the defeat of Germany in World War I. I mean, you can multiply this endlessly throughout history. So it meets this deep-seated need. In Christian language, Girard, in a sense, is giving a new interpretation of Augustine's doctrine of original sin, that there's a primordial warping of our nature. Even though our nature, as it comes from God in Christian theology, is in itself good, there's this warping of both the way we perceive the world and the way we act, that, in a sense, precedes our own individual action. And so the scapegoat mechanism, when it's really operative, is invisible. If you can name it as a scapegoat mechanism, you're already seeing through it, and you're not really scapegoating, in Girard's sense of the term.
Mm.
It's most powerful when people really believe this other group is the source of all their problems. And this can take place on any level. This can take place in a family.
Right.
Where, like, a particular child will be named the source of the problems of the family,
right,
which means other people don't have to look at their own responsibility.
Right.
It can take place in a town. So whatever the size community, this can be played out.
Mm. Thank you very much for that insight. Now, when in all of your years in interreligious dialogue and in all the many ways you've served on organizations, could you share some about your experiences in terms of how perhaps this has been addressed? How does it come up? What are the obstacles in interreligious dialogue, and what are the hopeful signs?
Well, it's another big set of questions. I think one of the most moving experiences for me was the first Gethsemane encounter. This was at Thomas Merton's monastery near Louisville, Kentucky, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Mahagosananda, the patriarch of Cambodian Buddhism, who just died a couple of years ago. So you had people representing peoples who had gone through tremendous suffering. And the topic, as it was set out, was supposed to be monastic life, the different forms. So these were Buddhist and Catholic monastics. But because of the whole condition of the world, we kept talking about violence and Buddhist and Catholic ways to respond to violence. And Mahagosananda was one of the most moving. He was revered as the Gandhi of Southeast Asia. He had organized monks in peace walks during the fighting in Cambodia, Kampuchea, where the monks would walk like 20 paces apart and walk between the battle lines, hoping to get the soldiers to stop shooting, and often it would work. And then there was a particularly moving exchange when a Japanese Zen Buddhist leader, Eisho Nishimura, spoke, and he recalled visiting one of the refugee camps in Thailand, just the other side of the border from Cambodia during this period. And these were people who had just fled with what they could carry. They had literally nothing except what they could carry. And on the side of the camp, there was this little hut set up as a Buddhist meditation center. And Nishimura turned to Mahagosananda and said, in that man, there was one person in that hut, there was one man sitting. And that man was you. My question to you is, and this is a classic Zen question, what were you doing in a place in which there's nothing to do? And Mahagosananda, without stopping a moment, just said, I was seeking peace within myself so I could bring peace to others. And so that represented one of the classic Buddhist responses to a world of overwhelming violence. And Mahagosananda had just come from this overwhelming scene of destruction in Cambodia during those years. And then people were trying to get him to kind of do kind of Western-style planning for nonviolent protests and all, and he would just say these little Buddhist one-line wisdom statements.
One-liners?
Yeah, and was more like the kind of this gnomic wisdom. And then finally someone asked him if he would lead us in walking meditation to the grave of Thomas Merton. And this was not planned in the program, but it was just an inspired suggestion at the moment. So he led us out of the chapter room at the Abbey, and behind, we went outside, it was a beautiful day, we went outside behind the apse, so along the path that leads through the graveyard, and then on the other side of the church, there's the cross at the grave of Thomas Merton, and he stood behind there, and the rest of us stood in silence around. And it was just one of the most moving experiences I've had in interreligious dialogue. Another moving moment there was Norman Zoketsu Fisher. He's originally from a Jewish family. He's the former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, so one of the leading Zen practitioners in the United States. During this encounter, we would sit with the monks of Gethsemane Abbey in the choir, and they would chant the full Psalter, including the very violent psalms. And at one point in the week, we were chanting some of these really violent psalms. So later on in the dialogue, Norman Zoketsu Fisher posed the question for the Catholics, what does it mean to pray these violent psalms? And so a number of us spoke. I talked, I think, a little bit about Girard and all, and all of us knew there was more in the question than any of us had answered. And so afterwards, Norman went back to study Hebrew again. And he found a rabbi in the San Francisco area who was interested in talking with him. And he began to render the Psalms into English in light of his adult experience of Zen Buddhism. And so just before the second Gethsemane encounter in the spring of 2002, this was published as a book, Opening to You. And actually, I drove with him in the car into Louisville one night where his publisher had arranged a book signing evening for him at a bookstore. So we had a long talk on this. So it's one example of how kind of a classic question about violence in religious texts can lead to this interreligious journey touching on multiple traditions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Leo. The issue of violence, the pain that's caused from it, the very real pain that's in the world. For when one minister somewhere threatens to burn a book, someone else's holy book, and some child on the other side of the world dies in a riot as a result of it. This is massive, you know, psychic and spiritual and physical suffering about religion and religious ideas, when in fact perhaps the, you know, people have not even read the books and not read each other's books. It sounds like a good starting place to me to be looking at each other's scriptures and reading them or praying them, you know, trying it on, as it were, through someone else's eyes to find out how it relates to, you know, a vision of God or spirituality or nothingness or emptiness. But that pain is real, and you know, we here at the Institute, of course, don't believe anyone should be suffering or hurt or martyred or anything over religious beliefs, and that is, you know, the way forward. How do we, including folks, you know, like yourself, so dedicated, bring this out into the world beyond the conferences, beyond the seminaries, beyond those rather respectful, I imagine, atmospheres and environments, and really out into the parishes and the streets as a point to make about this theology of neighbors you're speaking of?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was teaching in New York City on September 11th, 2001, and was living at a parish in Yonkers, and told the pastor I was living with that if he wanted, I would do some talks on Islam in the parish. And so in October of 2001, I began a series of three talks on Islam. They had more people than had ever come out before for any adult education thing. And I just tried to describe both the origins, the classic forms, and the encounter of Islam with modernity, and tried to explain the context of those who do a rather militant interpretation of Islam, but also stress that that violates traditional Islam's rules of engagement. And there was tremendous interest, and so I was doing those talks for about 2.5 to 3 years in the New York area, often in parishes, retreat centers, sometimes colleges, at the Graymore Spiritual Life Center north of New York City. Muslims from the Mid-Hudson Islamic Center came and listened to me. And so we engaged in a dialogue, and so the Franciscan friar who was director of the Spiritual Life Center extended the series. So we had a fourth session with the Muslims speaking about their experience of being Muslims in America, and then with myself responding to them. So that's one way that I've tried to bring this out beyond normal academic framework to people in parishes, and there was tremendous interest in one place after another. I mean, another forum is the Council for a Parliament of the World's Religions.
Yes, but, could you share a little about that organization?
Yeah, about every 5 years now we have a Parliament of the World's Religions, which is probably the largest interreligious gathering in the world today. They last about a week. The last one was in Melbourne, Australia, in December of 2009. We're hoping to have the next in Brussels in 2014. This is still in discussion. There's information on the web at parliamentofreligions.org, where you can find much information about the last parliament, and then there are ongoing activities in between the parliaments. But it's a network of people on all different levels, so including academics, including community organizers, social activists, people concerned about the good of humanity and interreligious harmony, coming together, facing the different challenges of the world's community in light of interreligious understanding.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And is that what you is that what you see going forward? Is that the vision for religious tolerance as neighbors, is going forward, not washing away our differences, but bringing them all to the table?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, the approach I use myself is to be both deeply rooted in my own tradition and also open to the wisdom and values of other religious traditions.
Thank you. Now, do you have any other books or projects you would like to share with us today as we could head towards the last part of the show?
Yeah, my most recent book is actually part of a series of Christian commentaries on sacred non-Christian texts. And when I was asked to contribute to the series, I immediately thought of the Dhammapada, which is a collection of wisdom sayings of the Buddha. And it's a text that I've read and loved for many years and had used it in a briefer context in earlier writings, but was delighted to be able to do a book-length response to it. So a colleague and friend of mine, Peter Feldmeier, offers a new translation of the Dhammapada and then explains the Buddhist context. And in the course of that, gives an overview of the major points of Theravada Buddhism. And then after each chapter, I offer a Christian response, starting from the biblical wisdom tradition as an analogous search for wisdom in ordinary experience, and then drawing on the New Testament, on the Desert Fathers, the later Christian monastic tradition. And the project I'm working on right now, which I just did a series of lectures in Kiev, Ukraine, on this, is tentatively entitled Hostility and Generosity, Christian Interpretations of the Scripture in Relation to Other Religions. So I'm looking at many of these issues we've been talking about, the transformation of Christian ways of reading the Bible in relation to other traditions. Often in the past, we read the Bible in relation, say, to Jews or Muslims in terms of a theology of holy war, viewing Jews or Muslims as related to the Antichrist, and this fed into endless animosity.
Right.
In recent decades, more and more Christians have been acknowledging the common values that we share with Jews and Muslims, and what I'm calling a hermeneutics of generosity puts in the foreground the values that we share, and then looks how we can move forward. Then I also look at our relation to the Hindu and the Buddhist traditions and examples of different Christians who've entered very deeply into Hindu and Buddhist practice and found that that enriched their lives as Christians.
Yes, and we've been fortunate enough here to encounter also other professors and, you know, scholars of other faiths, the, you know, Islamic faith and the Jewish faith as well, who are coming, you know, to the same statements of faith that, you know, especially among the Abrahamic faith, that the brothers. And one particular Rabbi Peter Ox, I believe, has an organization in which, you know, the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim students read their scriptures side by side.
Yeah.
And he says, we study in tears.
Yeah.
Sort of recalling the one family, essentially, that we are. And as you're drawing attention to, the larger human family that we all are, with our common ground at the core of compassionate beliefs. Now, if people want to learn more about your work, where should they go? Do you have website info? Or
they can go to the website of Georgetown University, www.explore.georgetown.edu. And if they look for my name in there, they will find more information about me and my writings and activities.
And that is Dr. Leo D. Lefebure, L-E-F-E-B-U-R-E, when they go there.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It seems we could speak again in the future about any other projects, new insights or books you'd like to share about. This is a tremendous and ongoing field of discovery and commitment you're dedicated to, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you this hour.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
And best of luck.
Thank you.
Now, today, listeners, before we close the program, I'd like to offer a tip or a reflection for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. And this is one on the difference between happiness and joy. I don't trust happiness, never did and never will, said Robert Duvall in his Oscar-winning performance in the film Tender Mercies. And we've come to live in a culture that requires happiness. The nuances and varying degrees of emotional life are less and less enjoyed as a form of expression in our society. They're not encouraged and often are not tolerated. When not visible or consistent, happiness is prescribed. As a child, I learned that the meaning of my name, Carol, is song of joy from the Old French, as in Christmas Carol. And there were times when I had difficulty living up to the name, I thought, because of life-changing events or times of emotional or professional trial in my life, particularly early on in my 20s. But looking back, I realize this was youth. This was life. And these were formative experiences of growth that helped me to become my adult self. Some growing pains and suffering were necessary. It was normal. In fact, it was beautiful. Perhaps I wasn't always happy, but then happiness isn't joy. At a time when American healthcare providers are providing psychotropic drugs to children in the United States at three times the rate of children in Europe, we may want to discern the difference between these two qualities. In his book, Happy Pills in America, From Milltown to Prozac, David Hertzberg redefines what Americans consider normal mental health and also shares his view that happiness is now an obligation of middle-class citizenship. Harvard professor and of psychiatry and medical anthropology, Arthur Kleinman, adds this to the conversation. By medicalizing ordinary unhappiness, we risk doing a disservice to those people who really do have severe mental illnesses. By medicalizing ordinary unhappiness, now there's a phrase, I bring this up in the context of spirituality because it's core. It's a core principle in our life. It's struggle leads to growth and really can't be bypassed entirely. I decided to do some research into my theory. What is the difference between happiness and joy? A discerning dictionary I consulted had this to say about the feeling of happiness, using words like delighted, pleased, or glad as over a particular thing, to be happy to see a person. It's characterized by or indicative of pleasure or contentment, a happy mood, a happy frame of mind, favored by fortune, fortunate or lucky, a happy, fruitful land. Obsessed by or quick to use the item indicated, as in trigger-happy gangster. I guess everybody's gadget-happy these days. But looking at these descriptions, one thing is clear. Happiness is fleeting. We feel it over a particular thing or person. Moods and frames of mind change often. Fortune deals us different hands throughout life. Money comes and goes. Actions, utterances, and ideas can be exciting, inspiring, and momentary. On the other hand, these are a few synonyms for the word joy from dictionary.reference.com. Humor, treasure, festivity, mirth. I don't know about you, but to me, humor is a constant in life. It has to do with our perspective in good times and bad. Treasure differs from fortune. What we treasure, what we cherish, tends also to be constant. Festivity and mirth are closely related. Mirth refers to the ability to enjoy and have fun, while festivity refers to rejoicing, good cheer, and the ability to celebrate. These are abilities, if you will, not passing feelings. Importantly, joy is sturdy and can withstand some assaults. It is foundational, not easily tempest-tossed by good and bad events or experiences. Joy is its own filter or lens through which we can focus our lives. When I was completing my dissertation for my theology degree, I holed up for a weekend at a small Episcopal convent where I could focus my thoughts. And there I met 80-year-old Sister Benedicta. At some point, we talked at length in her office about life, her family, my family. She shared with me the story of her infancy. She was born in Spain during the volatile period following World War I, leading to the Spanish Civil War and the rise of Francisco Franco. Her father was the publisher of a newspaper that vehemently opposed certain political forces. He was murdered, so was her mother. As a tiny baby, she was brought to America in the arms of her aunt. And what startled me about this story was not so much the violence in it, which was considerable. It was, rather, Benedicta's smile. She told me of these events, not averting her eyes or with trembling chin or tears running down her cheek. She looked at me straight in the face with glowing eyes and a radiant smile full of love throughout. She smiled. I can still see it in my mind's eye, an indelible impression. It was not a happy smile, per se. She was not happy for these events, of course. This was joy. Joy allowed her to perceive all the events of her life, the good, the bad, the tragic, the redeeming, and the hopeful, as integrated and woven into a meaningful journey, not a litany of sorrows, but a string of pearls. This cannot be prescribed. It must be lived. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City, engineered by Myron Bitts and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always love to hear from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed.